Welcome to the Intersecting Us podcast, where math and life intersect.
In this week's podcast, Brian and Dave delve into investing in others, discussing the love that fosters personal fulfillment.
There's probably many ways to think about this and say it, but one of the terms you'll hear a lot is that love makes the world go round. You know, the word love is used in so many different ways and cultures and has been in different languages. And one of the things you'll see that the idea of love is in songs. And why are we talking about love? Well, we're talking about it because it happens to be the title of the last chapter of the book, Mathematics for Human Flourishing by Francis Hsu. We're looking at this because it's something that he really looked at and wanted to end with. And so we're going to end with him on this podcast. But I was thinking about love being in songs, a lot of songs. I listen to a lot of music. Dave, do you listen to a bunch of music too? Or do you?
I do. Yes. I love music.
Yeah. And well, there you go. That's a, no pun intended.
Not the way I love my wife, but
yeah, I
love my wife. Yes.
Well, I thought, you know, this is intersecting us, so we do math and life, and so if we do have something with life, we try to geek it up and make it a little mathy. And so I actually looked up, and there is a study on love songs. I always thought, well, how many songs? What percentage of songs are love songs? Now, this is completely irrelevant to most of your life, other than maybe if you get on Jeopardy and they ask you this. But between 2017 and 2020, they did a study, and 64.5% of all the songs were love songs. So that
I thought it was 64%. So it's
64.5.
Oh, yeah. I think I missed a couple there somewhere.
Yeah. And I don't know how many significant digits we could go on that, but I would love to go farther into that for you if you wanted, but I'm not going to do it right now.
That reminds me of so many stories in actual science where, you know, you'd get this overzealous young person coming in and calculate something to the umpteenth decimal place when you know, in fact, that to the nearest millionth of a dollar, $1 million really would have been sufficient, because after that, we're just guessing. There is comfort in precision, even though it may not mean anything.
Yeah. And so, but I went out and searched it on the internet, and I'm like, oh, certainly they haven't done a study on this. And oh, yep, they have. Yeah. You got, even love doesn't get out of math. That's for sure. And I think that's good.
You know, if you're going to sing about something, I mean, if I would write a song, it certainly would be touching on love one way or another. So I think that's pretty cool.
And I think that, you know, when he gets it, he doesn't talk a lot about songs here, but he does talk about this as being kind of the ultimate penultimate, you know, that was mm-hmm. the community. And so now we get into the love. And what he is talking about really is in the middle, beginning of this chapter, he talks about, he doesn't want to talk about the love of math, although that's in the book, and we will talk about that. We have talked about that in the past. And he doesn't want to use math to analyze the ways that people love, you know, that which we just did with the songs. You know, the love he wants to dwell on is the love one might have for another human being and maybe because of mathematics, you know, but mm-hmm. it's the care for another person that he's really trying to deal with. And I noticed in this, in every chapter, I went back and looked, that every chapter he says, like if we're doing truth, he says truth is a human desire. You know, it's a basic human desire. Community is a basic human desire. You know, all these different. Well, I noticed in this one, he said love is the greatest desire. So he did put it at the ultimate. So I think he did a good job of that in some of his stories. But I know you've been thinking about that too in other ways. So maybe I'll let you kind of take here and give us a little bit about this idea of caring about another person and the ultimate value of our own lives.
Right. Well, I'm going to follow the trend, the trail that Sue put together, and just focus in on how we can love one another. And to me, math has trained me in order to do that in a better way. You know, I think love ultimately comes down to a choice, and you can have all these techniques and it doesn't do any good if you don't really want to choose to love someone. But one of the things I've learned in math is that there is this idea of withholding judgment about something that is true. And so if you think about, you know, I was just talking about the Pythagorean theorem. you know, we may throw this triangle out there and we may talk about, well, you know, A squared plus B squared equals C squared. All right. Well, that's not even really too intuitive to me. So I don't even know if I would say I would agree with that if that's what you said. But then as we go through and we start explaining why we think that's true, eventually we have been able to turn that into like a rock solid proof. A rock solid proof means that math people are completely confident that is true, that there's no reason now to suspect it is not true. So, you know, someone could become extremely famous if they came up with a right triangle that was not following the Pythagorean theorem, but nobody's spending their time doing that because we know it is true. And the reason why we know it's true is because we have used a certain rigor of math in order to prove that. But then as math people, we learn that until we reach that point, we need to be suspicious of it being true. And I remember in college, I took this geometry class and the professor tried to purposely trick us and he would draw different geometric shapes. And then he'd ask us, you know, is this true? And we'd look at it like, oh yeah, that's true. And then he'd ask us, well, why is it true? And we'd say, well, you know, it's clearly it's true from your picture. And then, of course, he would draw some weird thing on the chalkboard to give a counterexample to show that what we just said wasn't true. And we're thinking, well, that's not possible. But then his point was, well, we didn't prove that it wasn't possible. By our argument, we just assumed it was not possible. And so what we've learned in math is to be cautious about believing something is true until we can prove it mathematically. And so what that to me does for back to the topic of love is that, Brian, you may say something that I think is like really crazy. And my first reaction might be to, you know, to dismiss it or to be critical of it. And so that would be a very normal thing for me to feel and then to let my mouth speak and communicate those words. But because of things that I've learned in math, there's kind of like this muscle that warns me, you know, wait, don't jump to conclusions too quickly. There's probably a lot of things I don't understand about what Brian just said. He just, you know, spoke one thing, but there's probably 10 things that went on in his head that he was thinking about. And I have no clue what those 10 things are until I start asking questions. And so it's this idea of withholding judgment on what people say out of respect for what are they thinking. And I think to me, that's a math skill that we can exercise and truly show love to others by giving them kind of time and space for them to have their own thoughts without fear that they're going to be judged by them.
Yeah. And I do think that he talked about, you know, in the time before, you know, when you're exploring and all that type of stuff, that you can't do that if you're going to be judged all the time, you know, and I think that you hit that pretty well. And I think he talked about the idea of when you're free, and that he even talked about that love is something that frees you up, you know, to love someone is to set them free. And that's kind of what you're talking about. You know, and not just maybe in their heart and their soul, but in their minds, you know, free to think about different things and free to withhold judgment and not be, I guess we would use the term judgmental. I think that's probably, you know, where you're just waiting for somebody to screw up, you know, and I think that sometimes there's teachers that obviously I don't think Sue would care for too much that, and he experienced that, I think, or people have where they're, I think it was one of the other guys in the book that was a Hispanic fellow, I think, that was trying to come back as a 40-year-old and go to, you know, undergrad classes. But he was told as a second grader that he is having trouble with subtraction. And he said, well, you should, you know, don't be stupid. You should know what that is by the teacher. And so he just thought he wasn't good at math. You know, it's just, again, it's back to that withholding judgment, realizing that if you're going to love someone or care for them, that you have to value them and not jump to conclusions. You know, how do I know exactly? Maybe they are bad at math, but let's give them a chance. You know, you can't let them. The flourishing part is always in the background. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think when you look at these encounters that he talked about, he really gets very personal in this chapter about his own struggles going to university away from, he was from Texas or was, is from Texas. And he went up to Northeast to go to school and his family was struggling with some stuff. And he was talking about, his whole idea was love. And in the definition we're using here is essentially caring for another human being and putting their, almost putting their needs first, which is, and so when he leaves, he talked about his mother. I had Lou Gehrig's disease and he was leaving home and he just felt terrible because he almost felt like he was putting his mom was very proud of him for going to, you know, an Ivy League school and all that. But he just felt like, you know, how much do I love her if I'm going to do this for myself, you know, you know? And so he really, what did he say? It was like 3 years, I think. And that just, and again, it's kind of back to the chapter before, he was vulnerable. He kind of puts his heart and soul out there. And and I think that's got to be helpful for people reading this. His care for people and the way he wants to do it. Because one of the best lines in the whole book comes in this chapter. And he uses the word, I was thinking about back in Prob and Stats, if you remember that one of the actuarial exams. And I don't know what they have. Probability statistics,
yeah.
I don't know what it's called now because I'm not really in that world right now. But
Exam P.
I figured it was probably had a P in there somewhere, or P and or an S, you know, but yeah, conditional probabilities, you know, we had to learn how to do that, you know, ifs and all that. But he talks about the word unconditional and puts it with love, unconditional love. And I'll just quote him because it's just so good. Unconditional love recognizes that each person has a fundamental dignity, which does not come from anything they do. I thought that was just really philosophically deep. Because it's what we would call in the philosophy side of things that human beings have, what we call intrinsic value. It's intrinsic to themselves that they don't have value because they can do something.
Right.
They can't have value because of who they are. It's back to the term we used, and I've used in a few videos that I've done in ontology, you know, who you are, what's your isness. There's different ontology, different nature of an animal or a, you know, a table or a person. And this is kind of comes back to the whole idea of being human is the idea that you can truly love the other one, you know, love someone else because they have value that they don't even show yet. And kind of a big way to circle back to kind of what you were talking about, the idea that there is a level of at least care, if it's not love, when you're giving people the benefit of the doubt when they say something you think is stupid or, you know, doesn't make sense, like you were saying. You give them, hey, this is a person, they may be just all wet, but I'm at least give an opportunity just to show some dignity. It's back to the dignity, I think.
Right. And to full disclosure, and in the spirit of vulnerability, that's been a lesson I've had to learn over the years as well, is to not be trapped by that mindset. So maybe that's why I'm kind of passionate about it, because it was a lesson in my life, and it was kind of a difficult lesson as well. But the cool thing is that, like a lot of things where maybe we go through a pruning stage, is when we're done with it, you just see that life is just so much better. And so, you know, I'm sure I got plenty of pruning yet to go in my life. And I've had a lot of pruning so far. And, you know, I can always look back on that pruning and realize, wow, that I'm so glad I went through that because it does free you up. And I find that for me personally, it frees me up to enjoy other people. It frees me up to not to feel like I need to be that person who is right and or to prove myself or, you know, any of those other things that really were underlying drivers in that quick to judge. And so I'm glad that I was able to kind of learn of that bad habit of mine. And hopefully it, you know, something that it happens much less in the future.
Well, and when you get into, you know, the relationships with people that everybody kind of knows, you know, you what love is, but it's sometimes hard to define, you know, it's you kind of know when you're in it. And sometimes I think we know when we're receiving it. And I think we know when we're trying to give it. But how to define it is sometimes hard. And I thought it was ironic, you know, having knowing, you know, some of the Greek language, actually more ancient Greek, but what it kind of permeates this chapter, but I think it fits to what you were just talking about too. It's the idea of it's a little different word. Actually, the Greeks have four different words for love. And they aren't mutually exclusive. You know, you've got sturgeous or whatever it's called, which is kind of more of a camaraderie love. And you've got phileo, which is kind of more of a family love. And then you got eroticus, which is more of a physical love, you know. So you got all those that kind of permeate our. But the one that kind of was the virtuous one that you see even in the Greek culture was called agape, you know, and that one has to do with the will. And I thought that was always kind of, because you kind of have to, because we think about love as being an emotion, mm-hmm. which it is, I hope. You know, I think we are created with both intellect and emotion. You know, I think it's something that sometimes they fight against each other. I realize that, but especially when you're in high school, I think, you know, there are hormonal things going on. But I think when you look at the love he's talking about, unconditional love, you're probably not going to give because only when you feel like it. There's going to mm-hmm. be times you're not going to feel like it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the Greeks picked up on. And certainly given that, you know, Christianity picked up on that too, and Judaism, and I think probably Islam too, the idea of, I guess that one of the definitions I've seen is something along the line, it's an other-centered sacrificial care. There may be more to it than that. So by definition, and you think about it, what did we call love of self? You know, that's narcissism. You know, I mean, if it's bad, I mean, you should care about yourself. That's part of it too. But it's got to have another center, and then it's sacrificial in a sense that you're giving up something for someone else, you know, and it doesn't have to hurt, but at least has to be, you know, something you're giving up. But you can will that. Like you go back to this, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't know if Francis, there's an epilogue, I haven't read through it yet, where he and Chris, the prisoner, mm-hmm. talk back and forth. I don't know if he ever went into the prison and met him. I don't know if you're aware of.
No, he did not disclose that in the epilogue. And the big story I got in the epilogue, for those that are wondering if you want to go there, but he asked Chris, what would you tell a younger version of yourself? And that was kind of cool because he said, well, first of all, I'd speak a little bit more harsher, direct at him because that's what I needed at that age. And so, you know, that's kind of an example of maybe tough love. And he realized in his stage of life, he needed someone that was tough love. And he said, I respected people that would do that to me, that would be direct. And he said, that's what I would have needed as a younger person. So anyway, I digressed a little bit, but there was a kind of a love story there, I thought, hiding amidst the that part of the book.
Well, and it's good because you brought up another aspect of it. You know, it's not, we think of love as always just positive and you just give people what they want, and almost like love is a synonym for acceptance. And I do think there's acceptance in it, but it's not loving to, you know, give your 3-year-old kid, you know, cotton candy every night for supper. I mean, that is going to cause problems. You know, and I think sometimes we have to, but you were, so the tough love you were talking about. But I thought, you know, I have been in prison and talked to people before. I wasn't convicted. I went in to talk to them as a kind of a study. But I'd have to admit, there are days I really didn't want to do it. Uh-huh. I'm like, you know, I want to go play basketball or something. I don't really want to do this. But
you don't go to prison.
I don't want to. Yeah. If you've ever done that, or you ever go in a place like that at maximum security and they shut that door, that sound is, I'm not going to try to duplicate it, but it's like, wow, it's kind of sobering. And I think love would be a good word for that, but I did it anyway. I willed to do it because I knew it would help. They enjoyed having our conversations, the guys in the prison, and enjoyed the time that week that we got to talk. So I think that was willful. I didn't always emotionally feel good when I went there mm-hmm. on the way there, but mm-hmm. but you still do it. And I think that's mm-hmm. the part that's more of the love that Francis is talking about. It's like giving of yourself, because he was talking about in his experience where he just really struggled and trying to get his PhD and decided maybe not to even do it. But yet he said, you know, the times when I had the most joy was when I was just tutoring somebody. And just teaching somebody about math and seeing the change fall in the meter and them just be joyous about it. And so again, it just shows you again, and there may have been days where like, man, I don't want to tutor, you know, this kid's never going to figure this out, but you do it because you care about them. you know, mm-hmm. and I think that's where our culture gets a little messed up. And I thought he did such a great job in this book. And what we kind of want to do in our endeavor here at Intersecting Us is like, yeah, there's this fine line I know from Tough Love and just being mean. I realize that. But if there's a reason for you to give, you know, to challenge someone because you care about them, then that's still love, even mm-hmm. though it may not be received as such by the person mm-hmm. who sees it the first time.
Yeah, I think this chapter on love is, you know, something that Brian, I know you and I, we could talk about this forever because it just permeates really everything that we care about because, you know, we enjoy being happy. You like it when your Bears win. You like when your Cardinals win and, you know, doesn't happen that often, but you're happy when it happens.
Trust me, not lately.
But you know what we really care about is love. And really it's like seeing that love flourish and in whatever form it may be. And I think one of the things, the older I get, the more I see true love is so much in the small things of life. And, you know, I've got currently 9 grandkids and I play with them. And, you know, of course I love them. I just love spending time with them, but there's just so much of that joy in there that, you know, I can't explain how much fun that is to spend time with them. And, you know, like you say, that's difficult to put into words, but you know, that is like really simple and yet pure love is, you know, that type of relationships. And so, you know, those are the things that we think that not only occur between grandparents and grandkids and spouses and family members and things like that, but we believe it goes through and exhibits itself through, you know, every aspect of life as long as we're talking about humans. And math is a human endeavor and it's a gift to us. And I think that part of what we can see as we do math is we can experience love in very simple and practical ways by showing dignity to other people.
Well, and again, you've used that word and we do. And it's okay to say I love math because at some level you do. I mean, or you love, you know, mm-hmm. the Cardinals or whatever. And I think at some level that's okay. But we're obviously talking about, like you said, something much deeper than that, that mm-hmm. you're loving, that love has to do with other people, you know, mm-hmm. and the relationship, because that's been such the big idea here. And we actually, if you remember, Dave, we did talk about that a little bit in our Eternity series on the life side, the philosophy side, about how, you know, that relationships, if they're eternal, that you never exhaust them. And, mm-hmm. you know, and love is part of that. It just keeps going and going. And you never exhaust the experiences. You could go do, you know, even now you could have a couple that's in their 80s, that's in a nursing home, and they get up and they do the same. But yet the experience is a little different every time because it's a person. It's not just a bunch of atoms clashing, you know, this is a person with intrinsic quality and all those types of things. So I think the way, and Sue being a teacher, I like the way he put it. It was very simple, but he said, you know, a lot of people will say, well, my job is to teach math, mm-hmm. you know, but he said, no, my job is to teach people.
Right.
I just thought that was, and I know that sounds so simple. And any teachers right. probably listen to this is like, well, duh. But I think that's a big difference. I'm teaching people how to do math right. and how to explore math. That's what he would say. And that's it. If I'm teaching the person, because that's the thing. Now we're talking about the whole person. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the, you know, I want to know, we had this in a few chapters before. I want to know if I'm a teacher, you know, if I have the ability to do it. And that's why you get nobody thinks about this sometimes. It's not just a math ratio. Well, you want a 15-1, 18-1 ratio in like college classes. Well, part of that's because it's easier to learn material, but I think part of that's because it allows the professor to get to know the students. Mm-hmm. You know, where did you come from? You know, mm-hmm. what do you do outside of class? You know, mm-hmm. what are you struggling with? Mm-hmm. You know, because I like the way he put it. He put it toward the end of the book. He talked about loving neighbor, which permeates all three of the great monotheistic religions. You know, it simply means to saying to somebody, you know, what are you going through and can I help you go through it? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's just another maybe good definition of love. And I just thought, we got a little time here, but as we sum up the whole book, you know, it's the idea of him just showing that it's about, this is the thing that's, you've kind of been waiting. What's the one foundational word, you know? And of course, you can always look forward and see that he's got the chapter heading, but he just did such a good job of bringing all those other things in that we hit. Mm-hmm. Because as you read this book, you're going to find out that these are certainly not all these different things he talks about, you know, meaning and beauty and truth and struggle and power, that they're not mutually exclusive. They all kind of build on each other and cross over, intersect, we might say. Mm-hmm. But I just thought the way he poured himself into the book, but yet he poured himself even more into this chapter. We learned mm-hmm. things about his life and his struggles and his mm-hmm. humility. Mm-hmm. Because the line, I don't know if we've talked about this yet, but the line that he has in there early about that he had seen himself as, he had essentially defined himself as being a mathematician, because that's where he got accolades and all that. And that was how he saw himself as being valuable.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a great lesson for all of us. I know for me, it certainly is. About where do we get our value? And it's so easy to fall into that trap that we need to earn that value. And one of the things he talked about in, I think it was this chapter, is that one of the challenges of math is that it is so easy to assign value to people based upon some sort of achievement. And that one may have been a little bit more in the last chapter, but to me, it comes down to that identity thing, is that most people, when they think about math, they may think of themselves, well, yeah, I'm an A student or I'm a B student. And that is such of a poor indicator of that, because on so many levels, one of the things that Sue has mentioned is that it doesn't do anything to measure your potential. And it really hurts me to see so many people talk about math like I'm not a math person. And that certainly is not true. People can tell time, and there's a tremendous amount of math that goes on in telling time. It's just that they've been programmed into thinking that, okay, I did not score well on this test, and therefore I can't do math. And so that just kind of can mess with your psyche and your mental attitude and things like that. And, you know, that is really sad, because math should be about flourishing. It should be about discovery. It should be about community. And I really want to encourage us all to take a step back and do a little self-inventory about this whole idea, where is our identity? And, you know, I think you got two sides of the ditch to be careful of. One is that I think that I'm super smart, and, you know, I'm that person that got the high scores. And so, like Sue was early in his career, his identity as a person was in his achievement of being math. And then it's the other side of people that don't feel like they measure up and don't think that they can contribute. And really, the bottom line that Sue alluded to earlier and that Sue alluded to is, it doesn't matter what your score is. Dignity comes from being a person. And don't let your math score or your athletic ability or, you know, whatever your hair looks like be any indicator as to your self-worth as a person. And I know that's so difficult in our culture, because so much attention is given to those things. But I think if you talk to people that what you may consider more wise people, I think you will hear a consensus that will come across and say, no, your value is not in what you do or what you look like. Your value is, you know, you're a human being, and you are valued just by being yourself.
Yeah. And I do think that's the foundation. You know, you will mm-hmm. flourish and be able to do great things because you realize I have intrinsic worth. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have to do good things to realize you have worth, because that wouldn't be intrinsic. That'd be something you'd have to earn. And I think that is it's a Christian virtue, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we like. But again, he talks about all his struggles in here, and the fact that I think it was just one professor that just said, you know, why don't you just keep working at it? You know, I'll help mm-hmm. you. Yeah, just something small. Right. But he invested a little time and I think kind of to end up here, I think he challenges, and I don't know his exact words, I don't have it in front of me, but he challenges, and I think we should challenge each other to invest in people who are going through challenges. You know, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. hard, you know, and people go through different things. You know, you might have, if you work in an office, you might have, you know, find out a little bit about some of your coworkers. Maybe you already know, but, you know, That's the thing. So it's kind of back to that old, there was an old movie called Pay It Forward. That's been years ago, but that's kind of it. You know, somebody invested in Francis in his life, just spent a little bit of time and cared about him when he was in a time where he was really challenged. Mm-hmm. And that changed his viewpoint. They showed mm-hmm. love, unconditional. And then now he's trying to pay that forward to other people. Mm-hmm. Not because he gets anything out of it as far as enumeration or anything. He gets it because mm-hmm. it just makes life worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I mean, when at the end of the day or the week or the year, if you can step back and say, you know, I made a difference in somebody's life because I invested a little bit of time in somebody who was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you help them through that, then the joy is so much better because you've shown that. And that's really kind of back to what true love really is. Yeah.
Right. And I have a very simple story that parallels Sue's story when he talked about taking his eyes off of himself. Is that, you know, he had decided to quit math because of his kind of depression he was going through. And yet he was in charge of encouraging other people to pursue math. And so he did it because it was his job, but he was going in a 180 degree direction the other way. But ironically, as he was now helping other people find their way in math, he rediscovered his own joy in math. And the takeaway he got from it was, the bottom line is, he had to take his eyes off of himself, that he was going through that depression because he was so focused on his PhD and putting pressure on himself. And that led to a depression. And he got out of that once he started thinking about other people. And my little quick story of that is, we went through actuarial exams. And I remember one exam in particular. This was back in the day when we all got in one room and took the exam together. And there was this other person who was super smart, like probably the smartest person in the room. And I don't think she had ever failed an exam, but she was always kind of like this person that worried about it. And I remember, you know, I was nervous going into it, but she was visibly nervous and talked about it. And so I remember, I thought, well, I'm thinking, well, she's smart, but I just thought, I'll just kind of talk to her about calming her down and, you know, reminding her, you know, you passed all these exams, and, you know, just helping her to not focus on her fear. And I remember getting done with that conversation, and then all of a sudden I realized my nervousness was gone.
Yeah,
because I had just for a moment took my eyes off of myself and placed it on someone else. And it wasn't like any big deal, but it was a reminder of how important that is to do that. And it kind of reminds me back in the days, you know, when we used to play basketball, Brian, and, you know, making a free throw really is not that difficult. I mean, in our day, you and I would, I don't know, maybe make 80% of them or something like that. But it's totally different when, like, everyone is watching you and all eyes are on you. And then the feeling is totally different. And the only reason why is because now all of a sudden you're worrying about yourself and what other people are going to think of you. And so that feeling of focusing on ourselves, you know, it is so common. And so it's not like we can avoid it, but I think we all will do better the more we can start focusing in on maybe other people.
And I do think that kind of is a good ending for the whole, the book, the Mathematics for Human Flourishing, and just kind of a really kind of a, you know, a mission statement for Intersecting Us. That's what we're trying to do, is focus on other people. Not only because it makes us feel good, but it does, but we believe there's intrinsic quality in people. And so if you really want to flourish, if you really want to have depth of feeling and worth, you're going to do that by loving other people and having other people love you. And that's why it's kind of what we're all about here, is to do that. So we do encourage you to get this book. Neither one of us have met him. I mean, if anybody knows him, let us know. We'll see if we can get him on. That would be great. But I do think it would be good, if you're a mathematician or not, to look at these chapters and the importance of all these virtues that he talks about. And it fits so well in who we are at Intersecting Us, where we intersect math and life.
This has been the Intersecting Us podcast. To further engage with Intersecting Us, go to intersectingus.com.